Native leaders voiced their concerns about offshore drilling.
It's really important to feed our families with the natural resources of the area, the caribou, the fish, and the whale, the seals.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 13th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, more than you might ever want to know about walrus.
They must have the world's tightest lips and the most powerful suction. I've been told you never want a French kiss a walrus.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Fostering safe, connected schools is a foundation for academic achievement through annual school climate surveys. Information at aasb.org.
Juneau's mayor today said he's actively getting involved in trying to find a state senator for the capital city. Bruce Botello released a written statement saying that neither Governor Sarah Palin nor the Senate Democrats are to blame in the controversy that has seen two nominations rejected by the legislative caucus. However, he points out that Juneau has not had a senator for nearly half this year's session, and residents would appreciate having a voice at the end of the session. Botello is proposing former Juneau Mayor Dennis Egan as a candidate. He is the son of the state's first governor, Bill Egan. Egan spent his working career in broadcasting, most recently selling his last radio station, KINY, in Juneau. Botello says Egan is still highly regarded in the political community.
Overall, he would enjoy widespread support among the full spectrum of the community. And when I say full spectrum, I mean the political spectrum. He did a very credible job as mayor. He's been active in a variety of civic organizations in Juneau virtually all of his adult life.
The consideration of Egan was well received by Senate Democrats. Majority Leader Johnny Ellis says the mayor's proposal should not be seen as a compromise in any way. He calls it a win-win settlement.
He has a name that is magic in Alaska Democratic politics and Alaska politics generally. So there might be a few environmentalists that grumble that they didn't get an environmentalist or an anti-road person into the position. That's not what this is about. It's a gold star for everybody involved if it works out.
Ellis says there will be universal praise if Egan's name is proposed, and Representative Beth Kertula, who has been among the choices by the Juneau Democratic Party, has endorsed Egan.
I have deep regard for the Egans. I think that he truly understands and appreciates our community, and I think that he would be a very good compromise all the way around.
The next step is up to the governor. So far, her staff has not responded for comment. Alaska Natives are uniting in asking Interior Secretary Ken Salazar to put a stop to oil and gas development off Alaska's shores. A draft five-year offshore drilling plan crafted during the Bush administration includes environmentally sensitive areas in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas and in Bristol Bay. Many who live in affected areas are planning to speak directly to Salazar at a public meeting in Anchorage tomorrow. He visited Dillingham today. In Anchorage, representatives from Barrow, Nuiqsut, and other communities voiced their concerns today. Doreen Lampe, president of the Inupiat community of the Arctic Slope, says there is little interest by the Minerals Management Service to heed Native concerns. She says an MMMS offer to include a 25-mile buffer zone to protect bowhead whales during migration is inadequate.
A science-based approach to offshore oil and gas leasing should include a 25-mile deferral area on the Beaufort Sea as well, because they don't just come from Point Hope to Barrow and that's it. They go all the way to the Canadian side through the Beaufort Sea.
Rosemary Atamarok is a former mayor of Nuiqsut and an ICAS member. She says there is a lack of knowledge about the effects of industrial activity on the sea creatures that the Inupiat depend on for survival.
We feed our whole community all winter long with the food from the whale, and it's very important for our survival. There's very limited jobs in our village. There's a difficulty in obtaining jobs in the oil and gas development around us. We're still very low on the process of getting jobs. So it's really important to feed our families with the natural resources of the area, the caribou, the fish, and the whale, the seals. With these foods, we're able to survive in our environment. With other foods, they do not last in giving us the energy or the heat that we need to live in the environment that we're living in.
North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta will also speak to Interior Secretary Salazar tomorrow, expressing his long-held belief that offshore development is a dangerous proposition to marine mammals and to the people who depend on them. Mayor Itta has said that until there is proven technology to clean up oil in broken ice conditions, then offshore development is too risky. Itta says tomorrow he will offer a new idea to Secretary Salazar.
Put real oil out there somewhere where there's ice and let's see what happens instead of just talk. I'm sure that environmentalists will get concerned about it too, but I don't see any other way to actually prove that they have the ability to clean up oil in ice-infested waters.
Itta says he visited Norway and observed testing that involved putting crude into the water to test methods for cleanup. Itta says the extreme distance from any marine support infrastructure is a major concern as interest in Arctic development ramps up.
If a ship gets crippled, where is it going to go? There's no deep water ports. There's, if there's a catastrophic accident, there's thousands and thousands of miles away is where all the help is going to come from.
Regardless of what the Obama administration decides about moving forward with lease sales, the Arctic is changing. Ice Melt is inviting increasing activity from cruise ships to tankers in search of shipping lanes. That's causing scientists and policymakers to look at how to respond to a maritime accident in the Arctic. APRN's Libby Casey has the story.
The University of New Hampshire hosted a workshop 1 year ago and asked its participants to do a bit of role-playing. What would they do if, say, a cruise ship grounded on Greenland's coast, or a tug towing a barge carrying mining explosives ran aground on Alaska's St. Lawrence Island? The exercise was put on by the Coastal Response Research Center, which focuses on developing new approaches to dealing with oil spills. It's a partnership between UNH and NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Workshop participants came from all the Arctic nations, representing government, academia, and industry. Amy Merton with NOAA is the center's co-director. She says they spent much of the conference talking over five possible disasters.
We really spent some time putting together those scenarios so that they were plausible and people could really think about them on what would we do if this happened today. And we answered those questions and then we really worked together to look at what would we like to do in the future.
A final report detailing the results of the workshop sessions came out in January. Merton says despite how different the scenarios were, they had some significant elements in common.
One of them was really managing expectations on how remote some of these locations might be and how difficult it might be to get there, just from a logistics point of view, but also communications is very spotty in the areas that we were looking at, so that everyone recognized that as a potential problem.
Merton says it's clear getting necessary equipment on scene could be a serious challenge, whether to save shipwreck survivors or clean up after an oil spill. So they brainstormed ways to make it easier. One idea floated by the group is setting up mobile icebreaker platforms, nothing permanent, Merton says, but places that could serve as international staging areas. Nancy Kinner with the University of New Hampshire is Merton's co-director at the center. She says another idea from the discussions is for designated ports of refuge.
You usually want to get that damaged vessel off the high seas into a more sheltered area where you can work on it more safely. A lot of what was discussed is how might we go forward to designate ports of refuge in advance.
That would require international cooperation. Kinner says some advancements will need to come through multinational agreements, but she says others can be accomplished less formally. Agencies like NOAA and the Coast Guard could make inroads with their counterparts in other countries. And NOAA's Amy Merton says scientists can cooperate. She says the center is partnering with the University of Alaska Fairbanks, as well as researchers in Norway, to look at how oil behaves in ice. It's a big unknown.
So both the freezing and thawing cycle, and really looking at the molecular level of what's in the oil and how those chemicals, which are the toxic chemicals, are transported, if they are transported to the ice community, the organisms that live within the ice and underneath the ice. That detailed study has really never been done before.
The Coastal Response Research Center recently had a week-long meeting on oil spill issues, and Nancy Kinner says they're in the process of forming a working group on the Arctic.
We will bring together people who are interested in funding research on Arctic issues. These might be federal and state and international agencies to try and coordinate the research that goes forward. So that's the kind of a thing that we need to do to get everybody on the same page.
Kinner says that way, countries won't duplicate each other's work and can instead build on past research. As the Arctic opens up, nations will be vying for control over shipping lanes and rich natural resources, but the Coastal Response Research Center hopes they can also work together to learn more about how to keep the Arctic safe. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an honest assessment of school lunch in Juneau.
Well, I like the salad because my favorite vegetable is salad.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Comfort Suites Anchorage International Airport. Comfort Suites, an all-suites hotel, is now open with a 24-hour shuttle service, indoor pool, and high-speed internet access. Reservations at 243-8080. Support for APRN comes from the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
Walrus scat may provide a key to understanding the changing Arctic ecosystem. It turns out fecal matter is more than just waste. It's a wealth of information about a walrus's diet, its sex, and even its stress levels. KUCB's Ann Hillman found out more.
Professor Andrew Trites spent 3 weeks aboard the Coast Guard icebreaker Healy in the northern Bering Sea collecting walrus scat.
And it's quite interesting to see when the walrus are hauling out, they actually melt the ice that they're sleeping on. And they create almost like little bowls of water. And these bowls of water become full of waste and everything. It's you really need a picture to see just what a mess they leave behind. But fortunately, they can just pick up and leave home and haul it somewhere else. But it's out of that that we're actually chipping with chisels and hammers.
With other animals, the scat has bits of bones or shells to help identify what the predator eats. With walrus, it's not so easy.
They actually aren't eating fish, and they're eating mostly clams and worms. But they don't swallow the whole clam. They actually shuck it. And so they can actually, they suck the meat right out. They must have the world's tightest lips and the most powerful suction. I've been told you never want a French kiss a walrus.
So the scientists test the fecal matter for different bits of DNA, which show exactly what the walrus was eating. They tested the method first on stellar sea lions from the Aleutians, and what they found was startling.
So we knew that in some of these samples we found the bones of salmon, but we actually can't tell from the bones what type of salmon it is. And would you believe it, but we found that in some of these scats, the salmon were actually Atlantic salmon, escapees from fish farms further south that are now passing through or perhaps even living up here along the Aleutians. So that was a total shocker to us.
Trite says he's not sure exactly what they'll find with the walrus. Too little is known about the animals. Along with the food, the feces also includes traces of the walrus's hormones.
So we've been experimenting with trying to measure the level of stress hormones to see whether we can assess what the current stress levels of the population is and use it also as baseline for the future to determine whether or not we have animals that are laid back or highly stressed. And that'll give us almost like taking the pulse of a population to tell us what condition it's in.
Along with Trites, other scientists aboard the ship traveled on helicopters to tag 17 of the animals with satellite trackers.
And the helicopter could land really quite close to them, just a few football fields away, without any animal seemed to notice. And from then, they were dressed completely in white to be camouflaged and used a crossbow, essentially used medieval technology to deliver 21st century technology to the animals.
All of these studies will go towards a collection of baseline data about the Arctic environment because, as Trites observed, the northern Arctic is more than just a giant sheet of ice. More than 450 species live on, in, or near the ice. And the ice sheet itself serves as a sort of farm that feeds the rest of the ocean. Fields of algae grow on the bottom of the ice and then fall to the ocean floor.
And without that ice, you're probably looking at another couple of months before enough light was getting down into the water to kickstart the growing season for the Bering Sea.
But what will the ecosystem be like if the ice melts? Where will the walrus breed? What will the clams at the bottom eat?
The reality is that in Bering Sea, we don't understand it too well today. So how can we prepare for the future if we don't already have a good baseline?
Trites says walrus scat is just another tool for understanding the entire changing Arctic. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
The Juneau School Board last week voted to continue contracting school food work to NANA Management Services for another year. NANA signed on in May 2008 after the state gave the school district's food service program a failing grade. KTOO's Rebecca Shear has more.
You gotta admit, more often than not, school lunch gets a bad rap.
There's this rice, sour, like chicken, and we call it cat food. The chicken fajita is cat food on like a rug. And this one thing called Spanish mac, it was supposed to be like Spanish macaroni and cheese, and we called that cat puke.
A bad rap of the feline variety, perhaps, for this Juneau Douglas High School freshman anyway, but a bad rap all the same. And if your name is Greg Rejester, you take that to heart.
Occasionally, my feelings get hurt, but I try not to let it show.
Thick skin.
Thick skin, yes.
But NANA's food and facilities manager says that when he does hear people criticize the food,
sometimes mystery meat and what is really that lunch that we're looking at,
he uses it as an opportunity
to talk to the kids or the patrons and find out what is it exactly that you're seeing, what is it that you don't like, what is it that you're looking for.
In Juneau, that's meant conducting a vote and be heard survey, asking kids what they like and dislike as they go through the line, and taking a good hard look at month-to-month sales.
And that way we can adjust pairings, we can adjust menu items.
First of all, I really want to say it's definitely superior to what we had, and the price is much more reasonable. So a whole lot of parents are taking advantage of it.
Including this parent, school board member Destiny Sargent.
But somewhere around the middle of the year, after the first quarter, I started getting some hints from different people that they weren't quite as satisfied because they were serving some of the same kinds of things repetitively. And then I started hearing, for instance, they have apples a lot, I guess, and a lot of times they're mealy.
Sargent's also heard about wilted salads, portions that are too large or small for the age group being served. Again, she strongly prefers NANA to its predecessor, ESS, and she recognizes the benefits of letting someone else do all the staffing and menuing and ordering and producing and serving and cleaning.
Some of the pros are, if they're doing a really good job, then, you know, the headache doesn't belong to us. On the other hand, we have less control.
Which is why she's in favor of the district doing its own food service somewhere down the road. She says the board is already discussing the possibility.
It is a possibility, but it would cost the district quite a bit more than what it is now.
$200,000 more per year, or so says Juneau School District Food Service Manager Adrienne Schwartz, who's done a management analysis of such an in-house operation. Schwartz is pleased with how food service is going this year and says she's not the only one.
Participation has increased significantly. It is a little bit more than 50% higher this year.
And you attribute that to?
I attribute that to that the students enjoy what they're offered for lunch a lot more than they did in the past.
And even if our freshman at JDHS has some catty comments to make on that front, a number of the district's younger students over at Gastineau Elementary think differently.
So do you think the food is overall, is it pretty yummy?
No, it's really yummy.
What do you think of school lunch? Is it good? Is it not good? Is it yummy? Is it not yummy?
Well, I like the salad because my favorite vegetable is salad.
What do you think about school lunch?
I sort of like it, I sort of don't. It's in between. I mean, when I have their bruschetti, it's a little bit too cold. It's very hard to decide.
Of course, with roughly a decade of school lunches ahead of her, I dare say she has time to make up her mind. In Juneau, I'm Rebecca Shear.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Senate today approved changes to the state's unemployment insurance rules, opening the way for receiving economic stimulus assistance. The federal stimulus plan offers $16 million to go to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, and the only requirement is a change in the eligibility standards. Sponsor Johnny Ellis of Anchorage said the changes directly affect 1,300 individuals.
I do want to state very clearly for the record that this is one-time funding. I acknowledge that. Everyone involved in this discussion has acknowledged that, so that is now part of the public record. But in a sense, the UI Trust Fund money is an ongoing benefit to businesses and workers and the state interest.
There's another side to the bill. Finance co-chair Bert Stedman said if the bill doesn't pass, there are consequences. He said the changes are necessary to put the state in compliance with the Federal Unemployment Tax Act. Alaska had an exemption to that act that expired a year ago. Without those changes, the state would lose about $20 million a year. But he said that's not the big risk.
In addition to the risk of losing federal grants, if we fail to enact this legislation, we risk losing the federal unemployment tax credit of 5.4%, resulting in approximately $111 million in annual federal tax credits to Alaska employers. Specifically, federal law requires states to cover services performing by employees of tribal entities and must give federally recognized tribes the choice of becoming reimbursable employers for the payment of unemployment insurance taxes.
The bill next goes to the House for consideration before the end of the session on Sunday. A new public works spending plan includes funding for state ferry repairs, but there's no money for new vessels or to resurrect a canceled ferry route. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Alaska Marine Highway System is planning for a new group of ferries to replace aging ships in the fleet. It already has $60 million set aside for the first vessel. But it's not enough, and system supporters hope to see some more money this year. The latest version of the capital budget, assembled by the Senate Finance Committee, has no funding. Marine Transportation Advisory Board Chairwoman Kathy Romick says that's disappointing.
We knew going in that it was going to be tough and pretty doubtful that we were going to get a big lump sum of money again, but you know, we'll just keep at it because at some point eventually we're going to be faced with that. But we just have to keep fighting the fight and working it because it is our highway.
The budget does include about $25 million for vessel and terminal repairs and overhauls. That includes about $500,000 to install a computerized fuel management system on the ferry Columbia. Marine Highway Chief Jim Beadle says the small ferry Aurora tested the system and saved about 12% in fuel costs. It's now on the Tustamina and is being installed on the Matanuska.
It's like when you stop at a stop sign and you hit the gas real heavy when you take off, you're burning a whole bunch of fuel that you don't need to burn. So allowing the computer to bring the engines up to speed and bring the, you know, the engines down again and manage in between, it manages the fuel usage a whole bunch better.
The capital budget also okays plans to buy the Prince Rupert British Columbia ferry dock. It's the same facility that had to be shut down for repairs last year. Beadle says it needs more work, and the Marine Highway System wants to be in charge.
Prince Rupert has not been maintaining the dock. Really don't want to be in that business. And as what we're looking at is seeing if we can buy the facility and then we would have to rebuild the facility. And as this goes forward, this allows us to spend federal money on the project. It's not dollars. It's authorization to spend money if, in fact, we do get to buy it.
The project is listed at $7.5 million, though it could cost more. Legislative budget writers are also boosting state support for the Inter-Island Ferry Authority, which is separate from the Marine Highway System. The Senate Finance Committee's capital budget includes $1.5 million for IFA operations. That's $1 million more than last year. But General Manager Bruce Jones says it's not enough to resurrect the authorities' northern run. He says another $1 to $1.25 million is needed to restart northern service. He says he's talked to state officials about that money.
You know, they can't justify investing in that run at this time. And we're going to have to sit back and wait for an opportunity to present itself on that north end to even consider bringing that vessel back out.
The IFA's northern service began in 2006. It connected Kaufman Cove, Wrangell, and Petersburg 3 or 4 days a week during the summer. Ridership was low, and the authority decided last month that it couldn't afford to continue the money-losing service. A private group has proposed renting the northern route ship for an expanded route, including Petersburg, Wrangell, Kaufman Cove, Ketchikan, and Hyder. Jones says that plan is under review. There's no question the authority will continue running its southern route connecting Hollis and Ketchikan. Jones says the extra state money will help keep that run viable.
We need assistance with, you know, some debt service. $250,000 of that we're going to pay Petersburg back a loan that we got a couple of years ago. It'll pay for insurance and just other operating costs.
He hopes the subsidy continues. He estimates the authority needs up to $1 million a year in state support. The IFA's annual budget is about $4.5 million without the northern run. The Senate Finance Committee's capital budget still needs to make it through the full legislature and pass the governor for funding to be made available. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The House of Representatives late Friday unanimously rejected Governor Sarah Palin's stand against using all the federal economic stimulus money to which the state is entitled. On a 42-0 vote, they appropriated $450 million that the governor did not apply for. Finance Chairman Mike Hawker reminded members that a vote was not a referendum on the federal program. He said early in the process he had doubts about the sustainability of the funds, but he says his doubts were erased.
We looked at what this money can do or what it won't do. And I've, after a lengthy thought process, I've come to the conclusion that we can use this one-time money, and emphasizing it's one-time, frankly, like many of the other federal grants that roll in and out of our budgets, that we can do good things for Alaskans with this money.
Hawker said the only ongoing item he found with long-term requirements is a portion that will be used to hire new state troopers. Shortly before the vote, the governor still opposed the effects of the federal stimulus plan on the nation, predicting the consequences of increasing the federal debt. She also saw strings attached to the federal money.
I do beg to differ with lawmakers who say, well, there aren't really all the strings attached that the administration said there were to these funds. Yeah, there's strings attached to every single federal dollar that comes our way.
Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra said legislators had specifically looked for the strings the governor talked about and couldn't find any.
In order to accept the roughly $200 million in funding for our schools, here's what we have to do. Pass the money through to them. The state has a 40% rate of students who don't graduate from high school. 40% of our kids don't graduate from high school. Without this federal money at this time, most of our school districts told us that they were going to suffer cuts next year. Not cuts in money, but the money they were going to get wasn't going to be enough to keep up with what they were providing in a service last year. This money came at the right time.
The bill has been sent to the Senate for consideration. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska and Rebecca Shear and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.